ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake. Great to be with you for Soul Search, the show curious about spirituality and what it looks like in people's lives and communities. I wonder what I'd learn about you from the drink in your cup or the food on your plate. How much does what you eat reflect your background or even your values? On one level, food's a basic need, but it's also more than a way of nourishing the body. In some traditions, food and how it's prepared and eaten is a way of cultivating the self or feeding the soul. Ritsuko Greenwood has been practicing chado, the way of tea, for something like 50 years. For her, tea is a way of practicing harmony in her own life and in the world around her. To hear more about it, you and I are heading to Ritsuko's tea house. One thing though, if you happen to be wearing a sword, as in olden times, you'll have to take it off.
When you have a sword, basically you can't crawl with a long sword, so everybody put their weapon outside.
Just pop it on that special shelf there, because you will need to crouch down and crawl. The only way in is through that little door.
You just have to bend down and crawl into this very small entrance. That's the front door.
And it is small, maybe half the size of a regular Western door.
The idea is everybody humbling themselves and everybody becomes equal.
Entering the alcove, there's a calligraphied scroll.
Probably English speakers will say very zen, even if you're translating, you know. You have no idea. It's very zen. But the one I'm putting at the moment is Enso, which is the round figure, means nothing, empty. And underneath it, it says Mujinzo, which is endless supply, no end. You have bountiful of something. So it's very contradictory. But if your mind is full of things, you can't really create anything or you can't hear anything. People say you first empty yourself. Then limitless, bountiful things can get into your mind and you learn so much by making yourself empty to start with.
Definitely food for thought. But looking beyond the scroll, the tea things are all laid out, ready and waiting.
And you sit maybe comfortably 3-4 guests in the 4.5 tatami mats. And then the host will come into the room and have some exchange of, you know, greetings. And then she or he would make a bowl of tea each for you. Thick tea is quite an acquired taste. It's gooey. Thin tea is easier because it's lots of water and using the whisk, and it's like, look like a, you know, matcha cappuccino.
And with some food, maybe sweets.
That's the ultimate gathering we love to have.
So here we are in the tea house with our host, Ritsuko Greenwood. She's been practicing the Japanese art of tea for most of her life so far. Chado is about so much more than quenching thirst or nourishing the body. It's a whole way of life with roots in Zen philosophy.
What is chado? Well, chado, cha means tea, It's a more or less universal word, isn't it? Do is actually way, like a tower in Chinese, I believe. So way of tea, the way you live your life, like through tea, that's really weird, isn't it?
But is it though?
Yeah, it is. That's the good translation of what we do, because probably you heard kendo or judo. Ken means sword, so way of sword. And it's not just a kendo is, you know, fighting like a fencing-looking thing, but it's more than that, more than just fighting each other with swords, more spiritual aspect of it. The same thing. It's not just making tea and drinking tea. Well, that's the nice part of it.
Yes.
But it's more or less self-discipline and gives you some hint of making your life richer or easier or happier. We pursued. That's why it's going on for more than, 400 years.
Yeah.
And if it's just a custom of eating sweets and drinking tea, I don't think so many people in the history devoted into tea. So that's how I feel about it.
Oh. Ritsuko, I'd love to understand more about that longer centuries-old history that you've just kind of gestured at. It's absolutely fascinating. But how did you become aware of tea as something that carried those extra things? Was that something you absorbed in early life, or how and who from?
Well, it's very hard to, explain, but tea is always there. My mother practiced. But when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, doing tea, way of tea, especially for the girls, is a very good way to behave properly or like a finishing school type of education.
Right.
If you like to marry well, you just need to know how to sort of prepare tea, how to bow, how to talk, how to stand up, how to, behave basically. That was kind of superficial way. So a lot of girls around me did the tea. Powdered matcha tea I'm talking about, that practice. So that was the norm. So I didn't think about the meaning of life really very, very much while I was learning when I was younger in Japan. But I just loved that kind of movements and learning the intricate way of doing things. Mm. And at the same time, I felt really peaceful when you sit down and making tea and serving tea to other people and they receive it and have a wonderful atmosphere of interaction between the host and guest. I loved it. So I just kept going.
It's interesting that it was such a feminized thing in your early life, because I guess I've associated that kind of very cultivated process of preparing tea as something that mainly men did, in fact, something that mainly monks did.
And
so was it a new thing for that to become a marker of a certain kind of femininity? Is that new at the time you were growing up?
Relatively new. I mean, it used to be only men were allowed to perform in front of other people, very men-oriented art since in the 16th century, really, or before that as well. But, Sen no Rikyu, who is a founder. And it was always men's job. And as you know, the Meiji Restoration, we opened up the countries and the social change was enormous. We realized we need to catch up with the Western world because we were sleeping 2.5 centuries of isolation. So they tend to neglect the old tradition of tea or sword or, fighting because they realize, gee, we have to catch up with the rest of the world. And only things to save from extinction is to start educating the young girls who started to go to, you know, higher education, tertiary education, which they didn't get allowed before. For example, if, you know, we had a lot of wars, you know, China with Russia and First World War, a lot of women became widowed. They didn't have much social welfare. And a lot of those widows made living out of teaching tea. So the Meiji Restoration was 1867. After that, you know, the proportion of male and female totally went upside down. So either male or female, we're all human being. So I don't think it doesn't matter. So
it sounds like your early introduction to the art was very kind of feminized, very almost surface level, if I think you used that word yourself
Thank
before.
You.
So when, for you, did the art of tea and art as an art of living become something that you embraced for yourself?
I know that because I clearly remember when I first came to Australia in 1985, and I realized I didn't know much about Japan, and I did tea, but I didn't actually put tea practice and my thinking or spiritual, you know, or attitude together. I just did tea because I loved it and people did it.
Yes.
But when I came to Australia, I realized, gosh, the things I've been doing is more important or has got more meaning, because when I talk to my Australian friends about what we do, they're really interested in the spiritual side of it. Like when I talk about Zen Buddhism or, you know, just harmony, respect, that kind of principles tea have. It has a lot to do with modern people, regardless of the nationality. Australians are particularly interested in that sort of deeper spiritual side of things. And I realized, wow, what I've been doing has got some more deeper, you know, meaning. And I've started to read and remember what I had done, and this was actually meaning of that, what I'd been doing. That's sort of a discovery.
Yeah. Wow. I'm so fascinated by your perception of the kind of curiosity of people in Australia about those deeper meanings, what you might even call spirituality. I think that's really real just from the people I speak to. It's a shy curiosity perhaps, but it's definitely there. And it's so interesting to hear that that was how you experienced other people's curiosity about this art that you practiced.
Yes.
So, but tell me more about that, because you've mentioned Zen Buddhism. You've mentioned that this is an art that goes back several hundred years. I mean, where would you trace it back to the origins of Zen in Japan itself?
I mean, China was the center of the world in those days in terms of Buddhism, or relative new religion called Zen.
Yeah,
Zen Buddhism.
Chan in China, but Zen in Japan, yes.
And in 12th century, leading monks, Japanese monks, went to China to learn this new religion. And as you know, I'm not a Zen specialist or anything, but the Zen is actually whole life, their lives of cleaning, cooking, eating, everything, their lives itself is Zen, part of their discipline. So Japanese monks, when they came back, I'm talking about this particular one called Yosai or Eisai, he's a late 12th century guy. He brought Zen Buddhism back along with all the other, you know, monks. But habit of drinking tea is part of their discipline. So he brought the utensils and tea itself, and how they're going to present and how to make it. Basically, Yosai brought the habit. That's why tea and Zen goes hand in hand. Even now, It's a funny story. They had to impress Shogun to, you know, Ashikaga clan was the Shogun at the time. So the Shogun, he loved the party and he drank so much sake. And next morning he had a terrible hangover. But Yosai knew that tea has got some medicinal purposes. You know, it's so good for the hangover as well. Mm-hmm. So he gave that tea to the Shogun and he recovered miraculously. And he said, wow, this is so good. I'll promote this tea to everyone, you know, if you like to go up the ladder of corporate ladder of Shogunate. So that's how it spread around. And then, you know, it was in a Zen temples, it started as a medicine. Mm-hmm. Basically, when you're meditating, you get sleepy, I suppose, tired. But this caffeine contents,
you know, it helps you stay awake.
Helps them, yeah. So
it's like coffee in the Sufis.
Yes.
Tea in the Zen
meditation. Yeah. Yes. So that's how, you know, they were secretly enjoying this, you know, powdered tea matcha in the monasteries and, you know, temples. But because now the Shogun discovered this amazing thing, so it spread with the warrior class and then the merchants, you know, because it's a good thing they can't keep a secret, you see.
It's Meredith Lake with you for Soul Search by podcast and on Radio National. I'm talking tea with Ritsuko Greenwood, who's been practicing chado for many years. It's not uncommon for the things we eat and drink to somehow reflect our values or even carry spiritual meaning. But in this case, Zen Buddhist monks brought the practice of tea to Japan, where it became part of temple life as an aid to meditation. Over time, the practice spread beyond the temples and the monasteries, and tea masters like Zen Norikyu introduced refinements to create the art of tea that Ritsuko continues.
China made amazing artifacts. So those people, Japanese powerful people, imported those amazing artifacts, and that they did some comparing and compete each other who has got what more expensive and more rare thing. So tea became quite flamboyant affair of comparing those.
Yes, it 15. Goes through a process, doesn't it, of being simplified and brought back to its essential and almost humble qualities, doesn't it?
There's
kind of an almost a mini revolution in the ceremony.
Yes, exactly. The swing goes back to the other way, going back and forth from the flamboyance or some subdued Murata Shuko and the Takenojo. Those are the people in the 15th century. They just realize, look, there are more subdued, close to home things you can look up. You know, you don't have to have a really big room of beautiful furniture or anything. Just a simple, small room can do what you want. It's more you can looking at your inner self rather than, you know, showing off what you've got. And that kind of, you know, inward looking, I can say that, yeah, the tea is becoming popular. Mm. And we will have this legendary figure of Zen Norikyu, who was born in 1522. He is the founder of the tea we practice, who just showed people the beauty is not only the perfection. It's like some of the, I shouldn't say scuzzy looking, but it's not so attractive tea bowls. It's not perfectly round, or it's got some, you know, flaws in there, but it's beautiful if you accept them as they are to hold and use. So look at the bamboos. You think it's the ivory is the best tea scoop, but look at the bamboos. We can just make our own little bamboo scoop. So that kind of realize Zen Norikyu is a good sort of a leader to make people's attention not only one way, but there is a different way of looking at things. Mm. You know, he's an amazing artist himself.
I can hear your admiration for him and his philosophy in the way you speak. It's very palpable. And I wonder just if you could just describe some of the most basic elements of the way of tea that he clarified in the 16th century, and some of just what do you take to be the essential kind of principles that he brought into view and made central to the art of tea that have endured, you know, into your own life and practice.
Right. There is no proof that actually Senriku said that, I don't think, but the four principles any tea practitioners have or follow is the wa kei seijaku. Wa means harmony, kei is respect, and sei is purity, and jaku is tranquility. So that four principles, we always keep it in mind. I mean, wa harmony, you know, like harmony with the guests and host, harmony with the season, harmony with the utensils, and harmony with everything. And you have just amazing harmony within the tea hut, and everybody becomes one, which is oneness, creating this oneness feelings. K is respect, to the guest, of course, and respect to the utensils, because the way we turn the bowls, or certainly strict rules how to pick it up, how to loosen the covers, and that kind of movements we have to learn, that's because you respect those utensils. And so respect the nature and purity. You clean a lot of things, cleaning tea hut, cleaning utensils, even in front of the guests, you clean the tea bowls and tea whisks, and everything is clean. But at the same time, you're cleaning, I shouldn't say cleaning, but cleansing your mind, spirit, to be able to make tea for you.
How is that? I mean, when you clean the bowls, or how do you experience that connection between the cleansing of the mind and the cleaning of the implements?
Interesting. I mean, it's a kind of, I mean, natural thing to do, for us to do, but at the same time, because your hands knows how to clean, so your attention, your mind is not actual movements, but it goes beyond that. So it reaches your mind to clean it, because you don't make it any attention of superficial movements of your hands, so that you can enjoy the cleaning process to clean and cleanse your mind. That's how we feel. It's like a meditation when you're preparing the tea. If you're practicing so long, you don't really have to think about the procedures. So it's like runners might have runner's high. The tea practitioners can have that kind of very, very calm spiritual mind. And the last jaku is the tranquility. If you practice this harmony, respect, and purity, you can actually reach this state of jaku. How could I say? It's a silence and a stillness. You just feel happy. It feel very, you know, calm inside. Achieve the inner peace, I should say. But we practice those principles through this mundane act of tea making. I think that's really
It's remarkable.
Yes, I think that's really bizarre in a way.
Except that how else could you practice something like harmony, except in the ordinary and everyday?
True. The things I love about it is such a, you know, well, unthinkable connection of spirituality through this everyday act of making tea. That kind of connection I found is very interesting.
Those principles of harmony and respect,
purity and tranquility, they're fundamental to the art of tea as it's developed in Japan over the centuries. But what does that mean for the person who embraces chado as a practice over years? How has Ritsuko been shaped or changed by her practice of the art of tea?
My partner always says that without knowing it, realizing it, the way I behave or think or act is so much to do with tea. I learn so much from tea. I don't know, I'm not a perfect person by any means, but I'm a happy person. I love dealing with people and I immensely appreciate the interaction with people. I mean, talking with you, I feel the harmony and I respect you. I just have enormous respect to people. That's probably came from tea, I think. And I don't want to be antagonistic. I just wanted to try to keep harmony whatever we do, whenever we can. So, okay, religion, if you respect each other's religions and keep harmony, and it's okay if they have a different things to believe in, or, you know, it's okay, respect them, accept them. That's the fundamental things to make people happier and more, you know, calm and more meaningful life. That's how I feel about it.
That's how you feel about it and how you practice it. I mean, you belong to a particular school of tea.
We actually practice Urasenke, which is one of sort of our the schools. So the previous Grandmaster Emeritus, he actually said the peace through a bowl of tea. Sort of bowl of tea actually is the world, complete whole world, and that you can have a peace within the tea bowl. Why can't we have that bowl of tea as a symbol of peace of the world? I know it sounds very, very idealistic, but if we can achieve that, this world is going to be the much better place to live.
We have an expression, you know, a storm in a teacup. It's the opposite. It's peace in a teacup, which it must be much more difficult than it sounds. Otherwise, this would have been practiced. And I'm conscious of, I mean, what you've described, the persistent and practiced attention that you've given to this art, to the point where, you know, the actions of cleaning the implements, for example, become so second nature. Yeah. And it strikes me, Ritsuko, that we don't live in a world where sustained attention is something that we actively cultivate very often. We live in a very different kind of world where, you know, we want instant gratification. We want the latest new thing. And so it's utterly striking to me that there is a totally different way of dealing with the reality of the world, and that is to embrace a very old practice in a sustained and regular way. I mean, is the contrast as sharp as it seems to me?
Yes.
Yes.
Because a lot of Australians said, how many years could I get this diploma and I can just start classes and I can teach? You know, how many years I can get the qualification to be a tea teacher? You know, that's a common question I'm asked. And I have to say, sorry, but it's a lifetime learning.
So what's the key to it for you? Is it, I mean, you obviously love it and it sounds like there's not really a way of being you without it. And yet, is it about making a decision to, right, I'm going to do this? Or is it too fundamental for that?
My case is, it's already a part of myself. So I don't think that's a burden or anything. It's part of me, really. And it's a tea. way of tea, this chado is amazingly forgiving, amazingly flexible.
What do you mean?
If you don't want to do it, they don't condemn you. They don't reprimand you not to do it, you know. They don't push you to do certain things. That's what I like about it. I mean, a lot of my students are going through the time of life, you know, having children, getting married, sickness. So many life events are going on. Even if they love this practice of tea, there's certain times they can't do it. That's okay. They have to go back to Japan for 6 months to look after their aging parents. That's fine. I always say it's okay. You do whatever you need to do now because tea is always there. If you're ready to come back, it's always there. Come back. Because they don't have any particular timeline. You've got to do this. You've got to finish this. So it's a very, in a way, I use the word generous. It's not that strict. Strict discipline, how to move yourself, how to deal with the utensils. It's very strict. But at the same time, they don't really bind you. They don't really restrict you to do this and what, when, and you can adjust that. And some of my students, after a long time of, you know, away from tea, come back and sit in a chashitsu. Chashitsu is tea room. And having sweets and drink tea together. And we talk. You know, that makes them really happy. Sometimes we just listen to her stories or something and we cry together. That's also good because I shouldn't say I'm like a shrink or psychiatrist, you know, room or anything, but it's a bit like that. It's people will, you know, expose to the other people how they feel. It's a very special place for me.
You described it as an art of living and, you know, as it's an art that's been a companion through so many stages and changes in life. What a thing to devote so much time and attention to cultivating and to sharing with others. You know, I have so, so enjoyed talking to you, Ritsuko.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much, Meredith. Thank you.
Ritsuko Greenwood has been practicing chado, the way of tea, for something like 50 years. And it's been wonderful to hear about what that means in her own life and about its roots in Zen philosophy. Ritsuko serves as the executive administrator of the Urasenki Association in Melbourne, and it's been my absolute pleasure to have her on Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake, with you on Radio National and on the ABC Listen app. This episode of Soul Search is all about the connections between food and spirituality. On one level, food and drink are among our most basic physical needs, but how else do they nourish us? How do the things we eat and drink express our values or our identity? Lena Jabaly is a Sydney-based photographer who's made a career of sharing food with other people. She's the founder of The Lebanese Plate, a website and a host of social media accounts with hundreds of thousands of followers between them. For Lena, food has become a way of connecting with others and standing up for her community, which isn't quite what she planned or expected when she left her first career in teaching.
Look, it all really started off with me wanting to kind of share my food photography with, not necessarily the world, but just, you know, share it, put it out there on social media. And when I first started this whole social media thing, I had just finished a photography course and I'd only been kind of away from teaching for like a year or so. Mm-hmm. And I was at home. I had just had my son, who's now 9, and I had a bit more time, which sounds really odd because my job was so intense. Having a newborn felt easy peasy. And I felt like I had all this spare time.
Wow.
And for me, I kind of thought, well, I have now this food photography, the knowledge of photography, and I had completed an assessment for that course which asked us to photograph a theme when it came to food. Obviously, yeah, because of my Lebanese background, I thought I've got to do something with Lebanese food. And doing some research back then anyway, I found very little really good food photography of Lebanese food. And I thought, this needs to change. Yeah.
This sounds kind of like a bit of a creative challenge, Lena, because not all food is photogenic, right?
No. And look, I mean, I can make hummus look pretty.
What's
but
the
then
secret?
There are other there's a lot of techniques, you know, with your plating and using colour, using fresh ingredients and things like that. But then there are other dishes that many people don't know, you know, unless you're Arab and you grew up with it. Stews and things like that, which are not, I mean, no stew's really that pretty to photograph. So, yeah, that was a real challenge. I thought I need to make these particular dishes look in an image as appealing as they are or as delicious to eat.
Wow. I mean, that idea that the image needs to entice the viewer to kind of get that stomach rumbling or kind of anticipating how delicious it would be kind of points to the way food is, I mean, it is such a social thing, isn't it? It's something that connects us to the person who made the image of it, of course, but to the person who cooked it and the person that we might then eat it alongside. What was the social context of eating these foods that you were photographing for you growing up? Were these family recipes? Talk to me about your connection to the particular foods you want.
Well, I never thought of myself as a great cook. I didn't grow up cooking. And in fact, in, you know, the beginning of my adult life, I basically just cooked whatever I thought was quickest and easiest. And the more intense my job became, it was just like whatever I can get on the table, you know, a quick stir fry, whatever, pasta, simple, really simple things. And for some reason, because I never was interested in watching mum cook, I assumed that these dishes were complex and complicated to make. And I thought, well, this is the time to learn it. And certain things were happening in the general wider Australian society that made me think, well, you know, I'm kind of losing a lot of my Lebanese-ness, you know. I'm not really using the language on a daily basis. The only time I really speak Arabic is with my parents. I don't even dream or think or in Arabic at all. And my husband's Arabic is not great, so we speak English at home. So I just thought, well, what do I have left of my, you know, culture and heritage? And the one thing that I felt like I could really still hang on to was the food. I needed to learn how to do it myself so that I could pass that on to my own kids as well eventually one day.
Lena, would it be too strong to say that you felt like, I mean, it almost sounds like you felt like your identity, what was precious to you in your culture felt is threatened, too strong a word?
I could say that I've had this kind of struggle, you know, since I was a teenager, I guess, about not knowing really where I fit in. I never felt like I totally fit into Lebanese society, although I grew up in a very Lebanese home. My parents migrated to Australia in the late 70s. I was born in 79. Mum was still, you know, wanting to hang on to her Lebanese culture and making sure we're brought up that we don't lose that Lebanese culture as well. So that was, for me, difficult because I then went to school and TV and all of that is something completely different.
Yeah.
Although I went to a very multicultural school right throughout my schooling, you still felt like we were all odd. Although we felt comfortable around each other, we didn't amongst everybody else.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're famous now for the Lebanese plate, but was there kind of a Lebanese lunchbox factor?
Look, always whatever we took to school was not like what everybody else was eating. We had Lebanese bread, labneh, which everybody knows now, but back then having a sandwich with that yogurt and olives and za'atar, for example, was not, you know, your kids are eating pies and what else did, I mean, they didn't sell anything fancy at our school canteen, I'll tell you. Back then, what did they have? Like those, like Chico rolls and.
I hardly ever got a lunch order, but
and
wasn't
Mum
much.
Didn't believe in eating outside of home. Like she didn't like that at all. You took whatever we had, you know, from home for lunch. But the teachers made it a big deal, I think, more than anything, unfortunately. And that kind of, because you're always told and all even just made to feel Australia is not necessarily where you belong, for me, it was a huge awakening when I went to Lebanon for the first time and I had just finished year 12 and I went on a trip with my sister-in-law at the time. And that was a big shock to the system because I went to this place where everybody was telling us to go back to where you belong. Okay, so this is great. I'm going now. And I very quickly realized that I did not belong there at all either. You know, their upbringing is completely different. Their way of life is different. I mean, we had the language and we had the food in common. But other than that, we're worlds apart. And so I came back to Australia and I was just going into uni and really kind of starting to explore more of my faith as well at that time. I never wore hijab throughout my schooling, but I really wanted to. And although I do see myself as a really confident person, I was really afraid to. And even though I went to a school where a number of girls did, I still felt like, oh, this is going to change everything if I do. And I wasn't sure if I was ready to take on all the challenges that came with that.
I mean, those are very confronting and, you know, complicated experiences that you were having at that time, Lena. So how did you carry your faith through those experiences when, especially when you, as you're saying, you weren't at the point where you felt that wearing the hijab was something that you were ready for?
I started wearing it. It was middle of my first year university, which was an interesting time to choose to do that because I'd already made some friends. And so when I rocked up in semester two wearing hijab, a few of them were really taken aback. I was ready for it. Like I mentally had to prepare myself that for the worst. And I guess I felt like I was a bit more prepared for whatever was to come. And I kind of just answered questions as they came. I lost a few friendships, unfortunately, but for me, I was like, well, it's best that that happens now than, you know, if that is a turn off for you to that extent where you feel like we now can't even have a conversation, then, you know, I don't need friends like that. And I've always been that type of person where I'm happy to sit alone than to sit around people who don't want to be around me. So it's not a good feeling, but at the same time, my personality is like, well, it's your loss sort of thing.
So what were you expecting in terms of when you say you're expecting the worst?
Sometimes, and even back then, although you do get, you know, the in-your-face comments where people say ridiculous things, but you back then, the kind of subliminal, more casual racism, and I felt that everywhere. I felt that in the classes. I was very fascinated by the study of people and religions too, and I did some sociology classes where I learnt about, you know, the major religions. I did studies of Arab-Israeli history. So you can imagine those types of classes brought in students who are very also passionate about, you know, their own religions and their own cultures, and some of them not very open-minded, which is a shame, because you're here to learn about everyone and everything, really. So sometimes I think if the teacher or the professor, if I felt like they were a bit biased, it was a bit harder to kind of say anything or speak up. But where I had professors who I felt were good in that sense, you know, I spoke up and I said what I needed to say. But, you know, you always went home thinking, well, that was really uncomfortable and awkward, you know. Mm-hmm. And people at the time too, and I guess to an extent now, didn't believe what I said. It's always like, well, then you must be the odd one out. You know, you're different. You're not like the rest of them. And it's always trying to explain, well, what do you mean by that? Because all the people, all the Australian Muslims that I know, you know, we're all similar, the way we think, the way we do things, the way we're living our lives. I think people for the longest time have been brainwashed to have this stereotype of what a Muslim or what an Arab is. And it's been the most difficult thing to convince people that that's actually not what we're like.
You're listening to Soul Search on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. I'm talking with Lena Jabaili. She's the founder of The Lebanese Plate. The project began as a way of connecting with Lena's own heritage and family, but it became a way of responding to racism and countering the stereotypes her community faced. Lena even made food and took it around to share with people in her neighbourhood, reviving an old hashtag, spread hummus, not hate.
So that kind of all started when, I'm pretty sure it was Pauline Hanson who got up in Parliament and said that we're being swamped by Muslims, something along those lines. And I kind of thought, well, here I am, my husband and I with four kids. she's probably talking about us. But then also at the same time, I thought, well, my children are just, they were just moving into high school. And I kept thinking, how unfair is it that these, if I, as a grown-up who was born and brought up in Australia, if I'm kind of questioning my belonging and if I'm kind of still at this age trying to prove my worth of belonging in Australian society, and even also at this, going back to what I was saying before, like I'm losing so much of my Lebanese-ness that I feel like I don't really have that much tangible connection to being Lebanese anymore. So if I'm losing those links, what about my children who also, funnily enough, even though I brought them up in a way where, you know, and they are proud to call themselves Australians and call Australia home, they are also still made to feel like they are not really technically Australian. And for me, that's not okay, that this is like two generations now made to feel like they don't belong in a country that where they are born and brought up, they don't know any other, you know. So for me, to use food is such a great connector, and I think we take it for granted because I guess where we live, we're so lucky to have it in abundance and it's so easily accessible that we seldom salute its healing properties. And I wanted to do that to try, because I'd built this platform, and so I used the food. There were so many people fascinated by, not just people from my own background wanting to know recipes and things like that, but people not from an Arab or Lebanese background wanting to know more about these recipes and ingredients. And so that's where it kind of went from just the photography to starting to tell more stories behind the dishes, the ingredients, what they meant to us, the feelings they invoke. And people were, you know, hummus was becoming one of the most favourite dishes around across the world. And so I thought, well, what better way to kind of build bridges? Instead of breaking bread, we sit around a plate of hummus. And so I started sharing hummus with different people around my area, other people that I was connected with, sharing it online, and that kind of connected me to people from all walks of life.
I guess you're speaking about the way that food can be a bridge for a community, to someone's heritage and culture, but also across divides is what you're saying, Lena.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by the way you describe food as a kind of, as having healing properties, I think you said. And I think by that you meant kind of socially healing. But I wonder if that is something that resonates with your faith, just because I'm aware that for many traditions, there are deep values around generosity, around hospitality.
Yes.
I mean, you used the phrase breaking bread, that carries deep religious significance for people in all kinds of faiths. And I wonder if you could just elaborate on that for me from your own perspective of faith. Like, what, why is food and why is hospitality through food important for you in that sense?
So religiously, Islamically, we're always taught that food is a blessing, you know, not to be wasteful with our food, and as well that food should be shared. So if I'm sitting with an abundance of food and the person next door has, you know, nothing, then I'm obliged to share what I have with them. That is such an important part of our belief, and the giving of charity, not just in, you know, giving money, but also sharing food. So you'll often find a lot of our celebrations and commemorations and all sorts of events that we have throughout our lives, sharing of food and actually giving food. So you specifically make food with the intention to hand out for us. If you have it, even if you only have a little, you still should always have the intention to share that little that you have. You know, in months like the month of fasting and Ramadan, for example, that month for us is one of the best months where we really have high intentions to do that, because the hope is over that 30-day period, you build those good habits so that you can then continue with it throughout the year. Food, religiously as well, it's through our scriptures, you know, about honey, you know, how great of a healer that is, a natural healer, eating dates and things like that. So within the scripture itself, ingredients and food is actually mentioned quite often, and we often refer to that and we lean back on those things that also come from scripture.
Drawing out some of the connections between food and the Islamic ethic of hospitality, that's Lena Jabaili, founder of The Lebanese Plate. You can find that online and with hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. Before Lena, you heard Ritsuko Greenwood talking about the Japanese way of tea, what it's meant in her own life, and how it's related to Zen philosophy. If you've enjoyed these conversations or found the connections between food and spirituality interesting, why not share this episode of Soul Search with a friend or a colleague? If you're listening with the ABC Listen app, there's a share option right there on your screen. If you're listening to the podcast on another platform, why not leave a rating or perhaps a comment? Special thanks to Hong Jiang and Rowan Salmond for producing this week's episode. My name's Meredith Lake, and it's been great to have your company. I'll catch you again for more curious conversations about contemporary spirituality with the Soul Search podcast on Radio Australia and on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.